From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with poet Billy Collins. Once named the most popular poet in America by Bruce Weber in the New York Times, Billy Collins is an American poet who served two terms as the U.S. Poet Laureate as well as the New York State Poet Laureate. Billy's level of fame is rare in the world of contemporary poetry, and his poems are witty and profound, often at the same time.
Poetry. As if it were not hard enough, whenever my pencil moves along the page, the pink eraser and points up, a little finger wagging, reminding me of our appointment.
In our conversation with Billy, we'll talk about how he got his start and get a glimpse into his writing process. We'll hear some of his poems, particularly the short poems found in his book, Musical Tables. And we'll also learn about what's next for this living literary legend. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I was wondering if you could start in this book, Musical Tables, reading the afterword for us, kind of as a way in.
Sure. When did my fascination with small poems begin? Maybe with nursery rhymes, but surely by high school, when I was introduced to haiku. Later, I started finding them in the work of some of my favorite living poets like Gary Snyder, Ron Padgett, Kay Ryan, and recently Charles Simic. I love the suddenness of small poems. They seem to arrive and depart at the same time, disappearing in a wink. These days, whenever I pick up a new book of someone's poems, I flip through the pages looking for small ones. Just as I might trust an abstract painter more if I knew he or she could draw a credible chicken, I have faith in poets who can go short. Small poems are dramatic examples of poetry's way of squeezing large content into tight spaces. Unlike haiku, the small poem has no rules except to be small. Its length, or lack of it, is its only formal requirement. The small poem is a flash, a gesture, a gambit without the game that follows. There's no room for landscape here, or easeful reflection. But there is the opportunity for humor and poignancy. And this minimalist practice has its masters. Here's one by A.R. Ammons. It's a two-line poem titled, Their Sex Life. One failure on top of another. At some point, I began to think of the small poem as its own distinct form, and I started making my own little contributions to the genre.
That's so nice and so well read. So this is an earlier one, right?
Yeah, this is very early, and it's six lines long, and it's titled Falling Asleep. Walking backwards into a dark forest, I sweep my footprints out of existence with a large, weightless branch. So that's like covering your tracks in a cowboy movie.
The apple that astonished Paris, that's kind of our Arkansas connection a little bit here. We're in Little Rock. Tell us a little bit about Miller Williams and just a little bit about the journey, your experiences in Arkansas and with that book.
Miller Williams, who was the editor at University of Arkansas Press, the editor of the poetry series. So I sent Miller Williams maybe 50 poems, enough for a whole book. And he sent them back with a very small note. And he'd put a paper clip around 15 or 17 of the poems. And the note said, poems I've put the paperclip on are quite good. The others do not live up to the standard that those poems in the paperclip set. That's a wonderful way to criticize or to judge a young poet's work, to find their best work and then judge the work by the standard set by the best poems, rather than bring in an exterior standard like, well, you're not like Wallace Stevens, so we're not going to publish you. He said, if you can write some more poems as good as the ones in the paperclip, I'll publish your book. I went right to the desk, and I think I tossed the other ones aside. I spent the next year or two trying to please this guy in Arkansas. But eventually, I sent the new poems down, and he said, I'm going to publish your book.
Music means a lot with us and our show, and you know, poetry is often so musical. Yeah, let's talk about music a little bit. And this is throughout your work, right? So much music, jazz, and here we have John Cage. And there's so much musicality. Of course, that's the title of the book. Do you write with music?
Sometimes. It's incidental to my writing. I don't put it on, you know, but it is on, mostly jazz in the house. I can't listen to anything with words because I'm trying to find words, and that's distracting. But instrumental jazz, if it's just in the background, I don't need it, but if it's there, it's fine. I can see myself kind of getting into a poem and turning everything off, you know, you're creating something out of silence, and I like to say that the poem on the page is sort of a displacement of silence. If you think of the blank page as being not only blank, but silent. Jazz man, I've taken some lessons and worked on some nice voicings for the chords, but all I have to do is raise the keyboard cover 1 inch and the cat dashes from the room. And that's true. We have two cats, and one of them doesn't pay any attention to my piano playing, and the other one, it just runs away. I don't know why. But I take it as a criticism. So.
Oh, really?
Well, in the poem, I do, you know. I mean, I'm saying, I took lessons. I worked on some chords, for God's sake. Come on. I couldn't be that bad. Thelonious morning. The breeze was slight and moved only 3 of the 6 wind chimes, which formed a minor chord.
That's great. Chimes and chord and ending with the minor chord, right?
Yeah, minor chord.
And I like the morning too. Are you thinking about like Thelonious in the morning, as well as like Thelonious morning, as in MOURING? You know, it's a little, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's what you see is pretty much what you get. Don Patterson said, if you read a poem very closely and with care, you'll see a lot of things that aren't really there.
And how about John Cage?
It's called 4:33 by John Cage, so 4:33, which is the title of a piece by John Cage in which you experience 4:33 of silence.
Where he just sat at the piano, right?
Yeah, getting back to silence. 4:33 by John Cage. As I listened, the scales fell from my eyes.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with poet Billy Collins about his book, Musical Tables. You do a lot of eye imagery in this.
Uh-huh.
Did you go back through and see? I mean, there's a lot of pupils and seeing and eye imagery. Any thought about that?
It's the dominant sense ever since Wordsworth growing into Tennyson. You know, looking is gaze. I gazed and gazed, but little thought. That gazing is the second, like when he repeats, I gazed and gazed, but little thought. That is sort of like gazing to the second power, you know, that intensification of gazing. But here it's just basically in the John Cage poem, I'm just, right. There's a pun on scales, right? Because you say something, the scales fell from my eyes is a cliche that about having an epiphanic vision, right? A realization. But here it's the scales of the keyboard that are missing.
You know, six petals on each iris, every other one with a small yellow streak, right? Just, I love.
Yeah, right.
Love it.
That's a good one.
This is wonderful, just, you know, the juxtaposition of words. And you do that a lot, even with, you know, you do it with the title, Musical Tables, in some ways. Would you read Oxymorons? And let's talk about Oxymorons a little bit now. How you think about poetry as kind of words that don't innately fit together, or maybe fit together in ways that contradict.
Sure. I kind of snuck this in. I don't consider it really a poem, but I love finding, like, found oxymorons. And so this is basically a list of seven of them, it looks like. Oxymorons. Family fun. Beach culture. Office party. Dog person. Children's hospital. Light pollution. Happy birthday.
The ending's great. Were you working to that end? Did you know you were going to put that one at the end?
I think so, yeah.
So, you know, you write a lot about hotels, and I'm particularly interested in hotels. Thoughts just in general about hotels. You write about good hotels, bad hotels. Why the fascination with hotels, aside from the fact you're in them so much?
Well, that's about it. I mean, if you think about it, it's the room is an attempt to make you think you're the first and only person in that room, but you're just part of a procession of people. Yeah, I was in a hotel Friday night in Connecticut, and it was quite a swanky hotel, and you could tell by the water that was on the night table, you know. I looked at the source, and it says the water comes from the Carpathian Mountains. And I thought, that's, apart from Fiji, that's like the most distant place. So I told them at the registration, I thought that, you know, tap water in Connecticut was extremely drinkable, but why do we have to go to the Carpathian Mountains?
Would you mind reading A Small Hotel?
A Small Hotel. When a match touched the edge of the page, my poem filled with smoke. Then a few words were seen to stumble out in nothing but their nightgowns, with no idea which way to run. Here's a poem. It's 8 lines long, called Bad Hotel. I told the woman from housekeeping, who was eager to do my room, to just come in and pretend I'm not here, which is exactly what I had been doing ever since I checked in. I try not to go to bed and breakfasts. I'd rather be in a third-rate hotel than a bed and breakfast. I just don't want to get... I don't want to have breakfast with anybody, you know. And I don't want to be exposed to their teacup collection or whatever.
You can't lose or win by writing a poem called Poetry. And on 39, you have one called Poetry. I'm glad you still write with a pencil, with an eraser.
Yeah, I like pencils.
Do you still write with a pencil?
Well, pen or pencil. I just finished taking a class in drawing with pencil, so pencil's good because I can do doodling too.
Right, I know you doodle when you make your poems.
Yeah. So this is a six-line poem. Poetry. As if it were not hard enough, whenever my pencil moves along the page, the pink eraser and points up, a little finger wagging, reminding me of our appointment.
That's phenomenal. I used to only write in pencil, and I think it was because I could see that eraser pointing to me constantly.
It's always pointing right at
you. Yeah, pointing right at you like a little finger.
Yeah.
You said, you know, that they kind of come to you and you kind of write them down and you find them in one sitting, but then how do you approach revision? How do you approach the idea of rewriting or reworking? I don't even like the word revision anymore. I just tell the students to rewrite it. But it is a revision for you, and you said you kind of look for the musicality and the tone and the moment and maybe the place. Let's say you wrote this one. What would you do to go in and play with it a little bit or fix it?
William Matthews said that revision is not cleaning up after the party. It is the party. In other words, making it better is the party, is the pleasure. It's true that in revision, I'm basically making small changes to improve the sound and the rhythm of the poem. And the reason the changes are usually small is that the structure of the poem, my transit through the poem, and we were talking about this earlier, the passage through the poem as it's finding its own way to an ending, that's all done in that one sitting. So I rarely go back and say, well, wait a minute, this stanza should go somewhere else. It's of a piece. You know, I do a lot of linkage using, you know, transitional words like meantime or also or now, so that these are turn signals in the poem guiding the reader through it. So that's usually and hopefully all done so that I'm not making structural revisions. I'm not taking out three lines and putting something else in. It's done. I'm polishing, I'm refining, I'm improving, but it's in no way revision, like seeing the thing anew.
Right.
I'm just detailing it like you would a car.
What do poets do? Well, they write their poem, and then what do they do the other 23 and a half hours in the day?
Yeah, that was Max Beerbohm.
Yeah.
The only problem of being a poet is figuring out what to do with the remaining 23 and a half hours of the day. Because he was famous. His persona was a great dawdler, you know, a great waster of time. And he said, the ant sets an example for us all, but it's not a good one. Oh, this is three lines long. Highway. Hitchhiking alone, I notice an ant walking in the opposite direction.
It just makes me laugh.
You know, someone pointed out a perfectly legitimate reaction to some poems is, huh?
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with poet Billy Collins.
Musical tables. No one knew what to do when the music stopped. Plus, the big tables were always in the way. But soon it became the new game, in spite of its pointlessness. Or was that the reason for its popular appeal? A memory. It came back to me, not in the way a thing might be returned to its rightful owner, but like dance music traveling in the dark from one end of a lake to the other.
A little more serious.
Yeah, and it's this would be called a hinge poem, or that's what I call them, which is a poem of two stanzas of equal lines that are set up to invite comparison. And this is a very odd comparison. Something came back to me like a memory, and now we're looking for a metaphor for remembering something.
And the last one I'll have you do is poetry collection.
Poetry collection. They mutter in the alleys of the city, the old ones who were not selected. So that just refers to new and selected poems. I've had two volumes of new and selected, and here we have, they're neither new nor selected. So these are the poems. These are actually kind of tough decisions sometimes if you have a new and selected, which poems of the, you know, you're trying to get your best, your hits.
Do you like the concept of new and selected?
I do, yeah.
You do?
Well, I mean, from a purely survival standpoint, they sell well because you're getting a lot of bang for your poetry buck.
But it's like a, you know, greatest hits.
It is, yeah. And I think that's why greatest hits albums sell well. And then there's a kind of melancholy, kind of invented feeling here of sadness about the ones that are neither new nor selected. Where are they? Well, they're muttering in the alleys of the city, poor things.
How do you make the selection? Not the ones that have been selected that are published, but the ones that I almost imagined when I read that, like not selected at all, as you said, muttering in the alleys.
Right.
Like the beat poets.
Well, I have a friend of mine, poet, a dear friend, George Green, and lives in New York. And I guess I've done this for the last four or five or more books. So if I have a manuscript together, before I send it to the editor, I send it to George, whose judgment I trust, and he gives me grades, and that's all. He doesn't make comments.
Oh.
He just gives me A to C minus.
Huh.
And we don't go to D.
No Fs. You don't do Fs or Ds.
He is right 90% of the time or more. And he points out the weak sisters, probably an expression we don't use much anymore either. And we occasionally, I'll call him up and say, George, come on, you gave that a B minus? That's definitely an A. And he'd tell me why and things like that. So he's extremely helpful. It's good to have someone to help me with the selection process, to have another another pair of eyes on it. I don't show my poems to anyone but George and my wife. And I usually show them to her as like the minute after I finish writing them, if she's in the house. But I don't have other poets look at my work except for George. I think of this as always a forward-pointing career or experience or role as a poet. It's always going forward in the next poem. And the only poem I'm interested in is the poem I might write tomorrow, or maybe the one I wrote Thursday and the paint is still a little fresh on it.
Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been a thrill for me, and I love your work, and I love that it's popular and at the same time so thoughtful.
Thank you, and I've enjoyed our talk. It's been enjoyable to talk to you. Thank you. All the best. Bye.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to today's guest producer, composer, and editor, Silas Height, for crafting the episode, providing the music, as well as mixing and mastering. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the poetic advice. Special thanks to Walmart Store 5706 on Bowman Road in Little Rock for the Spark Good Change Community Giving Grant. Generous funding for this episode was also provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to poet Billy Collins for sharing his wit, his wisdom, and his stories, and to help us avoid bumping into those musical tables too hard and too often. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Billy Collins. Poetry is my cheap means of transportation. By the end of the poem, the reader should be in a different place from where he started. I would like him to be slightly disoriented at the end, like I drove him outside of town at night and dropped him off in a cornfield. Arts and Letters is a production of Living the Dream Media.